Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the value of darkness? As decidedly diurnal creatures, we humans carve thousands of hours of productive time out of the night each year simply by switching on the lights. Artificial lighting allows us to work, play, and travel safely even when the sun is down. But there is a price for that convenience: light pollution. Poorly designed lighting plans and wasteful fixtures spill enormous amounts of unnecessary light into the skies above virtually every city, suburb, and town on Earth, keeping most of us from really seeing the sky. Around the world, billions of us live under a sky whose stars seem switched off at night, rendered invisible by all the extra light leaking from porch lights, street lamps, even outdoor advertising. The cover story of this month's National Geographic magazine focuses on the consequences of light pollution, and it features experts including Pete Strasser. He is the senior technical advisor for the International Dark Sky Association and has agreed to spend the hour with us talking about it. Pete, welcome to Think.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
A lot of people wouldn't necessarily think of natural resources and go instantly to dark skies. Can you talk about why we might need to rethink that?
Well, you've got to consider where the power to generate that light is coming from. We're looking at a substantial amount of kilowatt hours generated for bad design. And as a consequence, we're getting a lot of light shining to where it's not needed. So it's definitely, you know, a wasteful practice to take the task of lighting, say, a street and lighting places elsewhere than the street, most notably up. Any light that's shining up is waste, and we get to pay for that in energy costs and fiscally.
What do we not see on a moonless night in 21st century North Texas or anywhere else in the country that we would have seen centuries ago?
Well, just anything, you know, a little dimmer than the brightest stars, which is, you know, the glorious heavens. The Milky Way is probably, you know, a splendid sight that I've read the figure less than 10% of the populace under 18 has even seen the Milky Way in North America, which is, you know, really a tragedy. And, you know, the concept you don't know what you're missing, nothing could be more truthful than going out and seeing a starless night, just seeing an orange glow. And it's usually when people go to far distances that they see, oh my God, I had no idea that was up there.
How does light pollution affect astronomers and what they're working on?
Well, it's essentially you know, dimming the view. We say it's like making their mirrors smaller. If you have a lot of fuzzy air to go through with, you know, particles being illuminated by stray light, then essentially their instruments don't function as well. Much of the visible astronomy is severely impacted by light pollution. In fact, it was the principal astronomer at Kitt Peak in the mid-70s, Dr. David Crawford, is the one who noticed the encroachment of sky glow from urban centers and realized that there was going to be a problem. So up came the organization, International Dark Sky Association, which was founded after he retired, and been working now for 20 years to try to end the problem.
You talked a minute ago about orange skies, and I think we've all seen that, particularly when it's, you know, sort of misty or cloudy out.
Sure.
But it's also, I guess, a combination of light pollution and then particulate air pollution.
Yeah, and it even doesn't have to be, you know, a pollutant per se. It can be just simple opacity of the atmosphere with a lot of humidity. And you'll see that the further east you travel, that just, you know, there's going to be more natural particles in the air, whether it be, you know, a man-made or something out of trees or the relative humidity being higher, that all of that will be something that will glow with the excess light that's shining above it. You come to the desert southwest, or we'll have humidities, you know, in the single digits, and it's really astonishing how clear it can be and how dark it gets with some street lights in the area.
People think about astronomers working in places that are remote. You know, they're out in the desert or they're up on a mountain. Are there astronomical, boy, I'm going to get that out sooner or later, phenomena that they would need to observe in urban areas but can't? In other words, you know, geographically, are there places that just aren't covered because of light pollution?
It's an interesting question. Most of it has to do with climate and, you know, where to position their instruments, you know, $1 billion worth of instrumentation, you know, to put in a place where the sky is cloudy most of the year would just be, you know, irresponsible use of funds. Typically, you're going to find most of the professional astronomical observatories in about 30 degrees north and south of the equator, because you're getting, you know, it's a subduction zone where you're not getting a lot of relative humidity. And from that latitude, you can see, you know, a great portion of the sky. So they try to, you know, confine the instrumentation to be in that proximity. Even better would be on the west coast of a continent where you don't have a lot of marine influence. And if you get some altitude, even better, which, you know, in southern Arizona, that's ideal. We've got some tall mountains, some clean air, and we're about 30 degrees north. You go to the southern hemisphere, and you're looking at areas chilly. There's some, you know, spectacular viewing down there.
Pete Strasser is my guest. He is Senior Technical Advisor at the International Dark Sky Association. If you're interested in the subject, the National Geographic November issue has a cover story on the issue. I was really interested in how much wildlife is affected by light pollution and stray light that's on all night long. Can you talk about some of the things that have been observed?
Well, we're discovering even more and more that, you know, people are starting to pay attention. I think one of the earliest problem that was noted was with sea turtle habitat being disrupted, the natural occurrence of a hatchling. As it comes out of its egg and goes up to the surface, its innate response is to go to the brightest thing, which would typically be the moon over water. If it happens to be a street light over a street, then the entire clutch will go towards that and you know, succumbs. They don't make it. So there are regulations that are now imposed in many areas where is sea turtle nesting habitat. In our neck of the woods, we're looking at Georgia, South Carolina, and Florida, where there are restrictions placed upon areas that have direct contact with the beach as far as the type of illumination that can be used and the intensity. And in so doing, there's been a dramatic increase in the sea turtle population. You know, we had no idea that it would be such a terrific impact, but it most certainly is working, and that's a very good success story for understanding dark sky problems. Another issue would be bird migration. Where you have species of birds that, you know, move up and down with the seasons, they can get disoriented with especially high-rises or tower lighting that's used as the beacon-type strobe. They can get disoriented by that, and it's not uncommon in, they say, Chicago, Toronto areas to see hundreds, if not thousands, of birds, you know, dead on the street during the season because the birds will fly into them as become a disorientation or even fatigue. They can't do their navigation and do the north-south flight and get confused by that. There are several organizations that are now involved in trying to mitigate that problem. FLAP, it's called Fatal Lice Flight Awareness Program, or ABC, the American Bird Conservancy, is trying to increase awareness by informing especially the owners of these high-rise buildings, to turn off this unnecessary light, and I use that as a key word, unnecessary light, at night during the migration period. And it's a very effective thing. You know, the mornings after, you don't have, you know, piles of birds around the base of these buildings anymore. But it's kind of interesting, after you've discerned which lights could be turned off during the migration period, they seem to turn themselves back on again. So you've got this unnecessary light that's turned off, did a lot of good for the environment, saved money for them as well, but then they turn the lights back on during the period of when essentially it's not so important. So it's just kind of a curious, you know, return to a wasteful practice.
And in other cases, there are predatory animals that are able to really spot sort of more than their fair share of prey now because there's so much lighting out there.
Well, we see that especially with some of the bridges with, some of the salmon. In the Pacific Northwest, seals will congregate around some of these, you know, piers that have, or bridges that have the street lighting on them. That's, you know, spilling over into the water, and you get a feast going on. The seals have learned to adapt to this, that there's a really great source for food. things we discover along the way that we didn't really think would have an impact, and lo and behold, these unintended consequences arise everywhere.
Does artificial lighting affect plant growth in any way?
It can. You can see some retention of some, say, deciduous trees retaining their leaves a little later in the season. To say that would be a typically harmful thing to the environment, that hasn't been determined yet, but you can see, you know, in localized places, sometimes the artificial light does impact and the growth of trees, et cetera.
And I wonder if the problem is actually worse in winter because there's less tree foliage to sort of block the stuff, and in some places there's a lot more snow glare.
I mean, as far as the effect of the sky glow?
Yeah.
Absolutely, sure. There is, and it's also an indication of, you know, bad urban design. If people who put in the trees should talk to the people who put in the street lights. And you'd think there'd be, you know, let's not have the two compete, but, you know, it's quite often in, you know, municipal applications, one department doesn't talk to another, and they really don't know where, where the stuff is being installed.
And what about humans and our biorhythms? I mean, I know that your organization is not suggesting that we all sort of live according to the rise and fall of the sun.
No.
But there are some impacts on people.
Well, it's something that's been recently discovered. The artificial light has a profound impact on our normal circadian rhythm. I mean, as we evolved as humans, we have this diurnal cycle. There's nothing we can do to change that. And if you have artificial light shining at the inappropriate times of the day for your particular cycle, it can affect melatonin synthesis. And when you start messing around with hormone disruption, all kinds of unintended consequences, again, show up. It's been shown that high melatonin levels through the normal sleep cycle is an oncostatic property. It keeps tumor growth abated. And if you take that away and there's a lower melatonin concentration, it's been demonstrated that cancers will grow faster.
I wonder, Pete, as diurnal creatures, humans have this sort of inherent, maybe the word's not fear of the dark, but aversion to the dark. Do we need to retrain ourselves to embrace the inability to see clearly and the ability to sort of exist where we can't see every single thing around us?
Well, I think that's going to be a hard one to convince people nowadays that, you know, the darkness is absolutely safe. I mean, you go back to the time when fire was first discovered and it was, you know, deemed as a safe thing. I can see better. But the idea that more light is more safe is a specious argument. If you put up too much light or light done wrong, can actually be more detrimental. We call it criminal-friendly lighting. If you put in light that's shining directly in your face, making a lot of glare, something that obstructs your view, then that's certainly not to your advantage. I'd like to point out that our organization says dark sky. It doesn't say dark ground. We are proponents of quality lighting, of light done right, not no light at all.
Yeah, we'll talk about how that's done a little bit after we take a break in a minute, because we certainly don't want people to think that they need to switch off every single light that's out there.
That's the argument that I have to, you know, come up with is, you know, dispel myths. Every speech I give, it's no, we're not about no light. We don't want there's stamping out campfires. We're saying light to the appropriate levels, and that's what's going to be the safest situation.
Pete Strasser is with us. He's Senior Technical Advisor for the International Dark Sky Association. There's a National Geographic cover story on the issue this month. It's called Our Vanishing Night. If you want to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pete Strasser. He is Senior Technical Advisor for the International Dark Sky Association, which works to combat light pollution in the U.S. and around the world. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Chris in Irving. Hello, Chris.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, thank you.
I want to thank you for bringing this subject matter to our attention here. I'm a city guy. I've lived in the city most of my life, but last year we bought some land down in southwest Texas on the Edwards Plateau, about 2,400 feet, and it's just unbelievable at night to be out there and to look up in the sky when it's pitch black. And as your guest said, to be able to see the Milky Way galaxy, I mean, it's just like the most spectacular thing in the world. I wish more people could see that and really understand, you know, the beauty of the night skies and what we're doing with light pollution. I don't think most people even understand what light pollution is, really.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call.
Thanks a lot.
I wonder how often, Pete, that you meet people who haven't sort of realized the extent of the problem until well into adulthood when they finally, you know, get out of the city and experience that black night for the first time.
Yeah, it's really astonishing. I know in the for about the past 20 years going, the most popular ranger-led activity in national parks has been the night tour. And it's kind of a serendipitous thing where people come to natural parks and not really think that they're going to, you know, think of the nighttime as the most memorable experience. But hands down, it's what people say, wow, I didn't know. You know, people go for geysers and canyons and such, and then go out at night and realize they had no idea what they were missing.
So let's talk about responsible lighting. First and foremost, we are wasting a lot by sort of pouring light into the sky. What is the best way to shield lights so that we direct everything that we're illuminating down to where we need it?
Well, I think you said it, is shield them. Good design will solve the problem of light pollution. It's luminaires or fixtures that where they're not really thinking about where the light is going are the true culprits. The full cutoff street light, which is essentially a light that shines down on the street and not up, is the best design. And one would think, well, of course that's what they should do. Well, most street lights were called the Cobra head with the drop sag fixture on it. 30% of the light that it emits shines up, not on the street. And that's an incredibly wasteful practice. So you'd say, well, let's put a reflector there, capture that light, and in so doing, you need now 30% less watts to achieve the same level of illumination on the ground. Why wouldn't you do that? And that's the question we ask over and over again, is why isn't that done? And it comes down to, well, we never really thought of it that way, or that's the style of street light we've always used, and that's what the guy before me ordered, so that's what I order. And there's really, you know, very little thought that goes into actually what's going on. And you know, the idea that, you know, electricity is becoming more expensive, municipalities are saying, okay, where can we start saving some money? And just, you know, switching to a more effective, efficient luminaire is the simplest, hands-down, fastest way to save energy and save money.
Yeah, in part of my neighborhood, there are those kind of old-fashioned street lamps that are just sort of a white globe all around.
Yeah, we call them acorns.
Yeah.
They're put in to evoke the nostalgia that, you know, they're trying to duplicate of, you know, of an image of an era. The problem with acorn luminaires is in the original design, they contained a flame, okay, which was used for wayfinding for a more ambulatory populace. It's why the Victorian lexicon has the term lamplighter, because a fellow went around and lit the lamps every night.
Sure.
What we're trying to achieve is the same sort of visual decor that they provide, and yet fill them with contemporary lamps that have an insanely high luminance level. So what you've ended up is with something that puts out a hideous amount of light very close to the ground, and you know it's blinding to walk by. And if it's not shielded in any way, half the light it's producing is shining up. And, you know, you talk about that National Geographic article. The cover picture is just a perfect illustration of that phenomena where you see thousands of little pinpoints of light. All that is light shining up from one of those nostalgia-type luminaires. And it's really, you know, a tragic. You know, there's no need for that kind of waste. And the curious thing is, In most cases, those acorn-type luminaires are installed for how they look during daytime. At night, there's so much glare coming out, there's no way anybody could possibly appreciate, you know, the fine artistic decor. And I've never seen a lighting designer stand next to one of those things at night and say, that's good lighting. It's usually somebody who picks them out of a catalog during the daytime. They want a picture in the day of how it looks. And they're not really considering the task. And they say, well, if that's how they looked in, you know, Mayberry RFD, and people went down to Main Street and to the malt shop and walked around, and that's kind of the image they're trying to evoke. But they're not using, you know, the old-time lumen levels. They're using contemporary wattages, which is just blinding.
Are there particular colors of bulbs and kinds of lamps that are better if we have to choose outdoor lighting as opposed to, you know, different sort of, you know, color temperatures of light that you
can
choose?
Well, there's a lot of different ways of looking at that. From an astronomical point of view, you know, the professional astronomer is partial to what's called the low-pressure sodium, which is a very, you know, in my opinion, an uncomfortable yellow light. The reason astronomers like them is they can filter out that single wavelength of light that's put out. The color rendering of those is terrible. You can't really tell the color of a vehicle. You know, is it red? Is it blue? Is it purple? Is it black? So I know a lot of the police departments really don't like them because for witness testimony, they can't say, well, what color was the car he was driving? You know, it's not an issue for the cops themselves because they have headlights on the car and it illuminates it. It's for, you know, a witness who doesn't have the benefit of other light. There's that low-pressure sodium, though, for professional astronomers is the one that they really like to see because they can simply filter it out. The orange glow comes from the high-pressure sodium lamp, which is most common because of its how long it lasts and the efficacy, how many lumens per watt you actually get out of the device. And that seems to be where most municipalities kind of gravitate to, is some more of that orangey light. The really brilliant white light comes from a metal halide, and also coming up, LEDs are also, you know, putting out that light. The white light is one that's really not the best for astronomical purposes because it causes more, it's called Rayleigh scattering, and causes far more sky glow than does the high-pressure sodium or the low-pressure sodium lamp. But you see better under that light, so you don't need as much of it in order to give the same visual perception than you do of the yellow light.
Boy, there's a lot of things to consider when you're making a good choice.
It's a tremendous amount of options and choices, and you have to really consider what's the task at hand. What is the purpose of this particular lamp? Why is it needed? And then, you know, make your best choice from let the task describe what you need it.
So let's talk, Pete, for a minute about people who are just, they have their own property to light. A lot of people have those floodlights now. People are starting to switch on porch lights. They're screwing in those really efficient compact fluorescents, which I have to imagine give that white light that astronomers are not crazy about.
Well, that's true. Another problem that we're seeing is that they're more efficient. So a lot of people will look at that and say, what, I can get, you know, this uses 13 watts, the same amount of that comes out of a 60-watt incandescent, well, I'll put in a 29-watt, still save half the amount, and they're ending up lighting more.
So it's like Vegas on the street.
Yeah, they're putting out more lumens because they're saying, well, I can save half the amount of money.
Yeah.
But the it's really, you know, not a good thing. As efficiency is not the everything for a dark sky approach. I mean, you can have a very bad design that's solar-powered, okay, and that would still be a bad design that would contribute to sky glow. So a good lighting practice is putting out shields, motion sensors are probably the best thing a homeowner can do is to light when something is there and don't light when it's not.
Right, so bright light when you need it and the rest of the time it's just off.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And floodlights, if we're going to install them around the house, it should be pointed down and not out, which is what most of us are
inclined to. It's just kind of, you know, you think that's, I need to light up the countryside because then I'll be safer. Mm-hmm. Just from a good neighbor policy, I as a fierce proponent of property rights, say, yeah, your right to light up your property stops at your fence. It should be installed with a shield, something that would direct it such that you're not shining light off your property. I mean, we have ordinances that restrict loud music. There should be ordinances that restrict, you know, stray light. If I don't want your light to shine in my bedroom, I shouldn't have to deal with that. You know, and you shouldn't be thinking that it's your right to light up the entire countryside if you don't own it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's speak next to Dan in Stephenville. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Great program. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Oh, glad to have you.
I've heard some of the answer that I was seeking, but I'll pose my question. This is a, how do you manage neighbors kind of question. I'm an amateur backyard astronomer, and I live in a suburban, semi-rural neighborhood that had great darkness for a long time. Now I have a neighbor who's put in something that would be seen for 20 miles, and it's half a block from my house. And I don't want to make the guy mad. As far as I know, there aren't any restrictions or ordinances about that. Can you give some practical advice about how to ask them to please don't pollute my sky?
Well, you can, try the kind approach and say, introduce yourselves and say, hey, you want to come over and look it through my telescope? And just, invite him over and see what's actually going on. And see that that light that he's think is for his safety and protection is impacting far greater than his yard. There are shields. He just simply put something up that would block it from shining off of his property onto yours. And that's, being a good neighbor. Just simply asking him to shield it, not essentially turn it off. So if he wants it on his property and there's no rules around it, well, then that's his prerogative. But there is a notion of public nuisance. And you have a leg to stand on by saying, I don't want that light in my yard because I don't deem it necessary, and he doesn't have the right to shine it on me. All you're asking for is a simple shield. And if he comes over and looks and says, hey, that's a pretty cool sky, but that light over there is really bad, and you say, well, friend, that's yours. And they, oh, I had no idea. And often it's just a simple education. They literally don't have any idea that, what they're doing has an impact. I've heard many successful stories. People say, yeah, I had no idea. I'll tone it down.
We have an email from Bill in Dallas who asks about comparisons between the human stresses caused by artificial lights and those caused by the so-called white lights in northern latitudes. It says, I spent a month in St. Petersburg this June, and I can tell you I had a very difficult time sleeping well. I don't know if it was the jet lag, the mosquitoes, or the never-ending daylight that messed with me the most. What do you think?
Well, I mean, we're talking about as a species that developed equatorially, where we had those sort of standard day and night times, and as we move upwards in latitude, we're going to end up with light that's going to shine, much brighter outside of our normal rhythm. So in that case, where you live, where you've chosen to place your spot on Earth, is going to affect you. In that situation, we say put up thicker curtains, do what you can, to try to give yourself the 8 hours of darkness that we've evolved to have. I know there's plenty of people that sell very thick curtains and light shields in northern latitudes for that very reason.
Speaking of curtains, I wonder how much of a problem it is going the other way. Is there a lot of light spilling out from windows in sort of single or double-story houses?
It's insignificant in comparison. You're looking at one, an interior light. Maybe you might have a couple or three 60-watt lamps, which are shielded to begin with. You might have something on a ceiling that would shine down. So we're looking at a nuisance sort of situation here, not anything that would be contributing to sky glow. So from a dark sky parameter, doesn't really show up on our radar. From a good neighbor policy, if you're irritating your neighbor, do something about it.
What about, around here, Christmas lights are like an obsession. People,
yeah.
with the resources will pay money to have people come in and put up,
sure,
thousands of lights. Is there a responsible way to do decorative lighting, or is it something that you wish people would move away from?
Well, in those situations, we call it seasonal lighting. Even, ordinances at municipalities, they'll exclude those, saying, okay, every now and then the circus comes to town, and you can have that. We celebrate the holidays, put up your lights, go ooh and ah, and then take them down, don't leave them up all the time. So we're not about ending that sort of celebratory nature. If they want to, spend the money to spin the meter, I don't think we can really do anything to stop them. I think with new technology comes out, the LEDs are going to take the place of the little incandescents, so we're not going to have the 7.5 and 15-watt globes that we see so frequently. I think the LED will eventually take its place. But to put a restriction on that sort of thing, I don't see as being anything practical.
Pete Strasser is my guest. He's Senior Technical Advisor for the International Dark Sky Association. Let's go back to the phones now and speak with Catherine in Dallas. Hello, Catherine.
Yes, hi. How are you?
I'm great, thank you.
Yes, I am very much enjoying this conversation that you're having for everyone that's listening. I'm currently on a lighting task force here in Dallas. We have a lake, an inner urban lake here, White Rock Lake. City of Dallas is in the midst of doing a huge project out there, $60 million project. And along with that, they're doing a lighting of the White Rock Lake. At the present time, it's a very natural bird-watching lake, Audubon Society-designated bird-watching lake. Very little lighting at the present moment. We're trying to work with the city, the task force, to try to get them to do correct lighting. At the moment, there is bad lighting out there, but they have brought in an architect firm. And my question is, how can we help them move this project along to assure that we will get good lighting out there that will not interfere with the migration of the birds?
Well, you need to show up at all the meetings that they have. If there's any city council meetings or public forums where the input is there, show up. There's strength in numbers. If you can't get a lot of individuals to show up, have sort of a signed note or letters from people that would be affected by it. Another thing to consider is the concept of warranting. Why is it being lighted? What is your warranting criteria? Is it because we want to? Well, who is we? Is it the community as a whole that says we want this done? Or is it some developer or some lighting manufacturer who wants to make a sale? Try to find out why it's being done. And if there's no justification as far as a safety protocol, then I think you have a leg to stand on to at least minimize the amount of lights that are going to be coming into this natural area.
Back in just a minute with Pete Strasser, who is Senior Technical Advisor for the International Dark Sky Association. After the break, we will take more of your calls and emails. We will also talk about the world's first dark sky city, Flagstaff, Arizona.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is the Senior Technical Advisor for the International Dark Sky Association, which you can find online at darksky.org. His name is Pete Strasser. You can also find information in National Geographic this month. Their cover story is about the problem of light pollution. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. So, Pete, talk to us about Flagstaff, which became the first dark sky city. What did they change there?
Well, it was probably the first one that came up with any restriction towards, you know, lighting in general. And it was 50 years ago, for the sake of Lowell Observatory, which had the distinction of finding Pluto, depending on whether it's a planet or not, is still up to discussion. But that observatory, you know, it's a working observatory, and they banned those sky beams, or you call them, I don't know, searchlights type of illumination, because it would disrupt their sensitive instrumentation. They'd start at 50 years ago. I said, okay, that's pretty good. And then they adopted the lighting ordinances similar to what was done in Tucson and Pima County, where we are. And that's restricting the types of luminaires and lighting levels that are throughout the city. And for the dedication, we gave them this Dark Sky City Award.
Can you actually tell the difference if you're in Tucson as opposed to, you know, driving up a couple of hours to Phoenix, where the climate is similar, but you can look in the sky and see less in Phoenix?
Well, let me tell you, I'm in Tucson, and we've had a lighting ordinance in place since the late 70s. And it's pretty much restricting the design of the lights to simply shine down and not up. And we're a municipality of over a million people, and I can see the Milky Way from my driveway every evening.
Wow.
Okay, it can be done. We have three decades of data to show that our roads are no more dangerous, that there's no more any more crime. Pedestrians are just as safe. It's just we say we're going to light down, not up. And it's really conspicuous. You fly in at night. You know, I travel over the world and I look down and see what's approaching. And when you fly into Tucson, you see pools of illumination. You see where areas being lighted. You don't see the actual source of the illumination itself. Contrast that to flying into most other airports, and you see points of light, which is essentially bad luminaire design and light shining upward. The cover picture on the National Geographic is the best. It shows Chicago, and it's just this intense riot of points of light indicating every street. And that sort of lighting practice is incredibly wasteful, and it's fiscally irresponsible. There's no reason a taxpayer should have to spend so much money to essentially light up the bottom of airplanes.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Nancy in Benbrook. Hey, Nancy.
Hi, I hope you can hear me. I am in my car.
Yeah, we can hear you.
I wanted to bring up the subject of with the Barnett Shale that's happening in North Texas. There's a lot of gas well drilling raising some interesting questions of blending industry with residential areas. And your guest may or may not be familiar with that, but the drill heads for these drills are several stories tall, and they are floodlit 24 hours a day within neighborhoods, which causes a lot of local light pollution. And I'm just wondering if you know if there's been any means of addressing industrial lighting as opposed to residential lighting.
Well, there is. Usually try to have, zoning differences for an industrial site versus residential. When it's, literally right next door, there's certainly issues. You can always put on a shield. There's a piece of cardboard, okay? That's as elaborate as a piece of metal to block the light from going on to someone else's property is a very doable thing. In the case of a wellhead like that, I think we're looking at something that would be considered a temporary installation. And when that's the case, usually a temporary installation is exempt from most ordinances. But that's, not building good, neighbor-friendly relations, with the industry. You would think that, simply saying, okay, we need to have the lights on for a function of safety. We're, working with very dangerous equipment. Okay, fine. But put the light where you need it, when you need it, and nowhere else. You don't need your light. Their lights lighting up your neighborhood. You're quite fine on your own, but if they need to light their property, so be it. Just put up a shield. It's not a difficult solution.
What about outdoor advertising? How successful have cities that have wanted to do something about this been at saying that you have to shield billboards or not light them at all?
Well, in Tucson, our restriction is light them from the top down.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be done. It's very simple. To light from the bottom up and shine up into the sky is a wasteful practice. We have both types of billboards here, and different companies will put them in and say, oh, we can't do this, we can't do this, we can't change it, oh, it's too expensive, whatever. It says, yes, you can. Go to this intersection. That's the lighting you put in. It can be done. They go, oh, okay. The newer technology, these LED-type billboards, they're posing a particular problem. And they can be dimmed, so there's really no need to have them, be at full brightness all night long. I worry about the, as a driver, the notion of distraction. To me, it's irresponsible to put up something whose sole intention is to distract you and to pay attention to something off the task, like driving. And I would think that, just as a community, would not want something that would intentionally distract you from the task. There are reports or there are some investigations going on that the Highway Transportation is going to come out in mid-2009 with their recommendation on actually how to deal with these LED-powered billboards.
How wide does a dark sky area have to be, Pete, before it really makes a difference? I'm wondering if people who maybe belong to HOAs, if it's worth it to them, will they see better if everyone within a few blocks around them dims their lights, or does it really have to be the entire urban area?
It's the actual homeowners. I don't think you're going to see a lot of change that way. Most of the sky glow proper comes from street lighting,
mm-hmm.
and it's the poorly designed, cheap luminaire is the culprit. If they put a little thought into it might cost a little bit more to put in, but you generally use a substantially less wattage lamp, so your total cost of ownership and return on investment is quite swift when you, you know, simply put in less wattage lamp to get the illumination you need. Take someone with a little forethought or someone that has to adhere to an ordinance, and it can be done. Say, come to Tucson, you can see it. It does work.
We have an email from, looks like, Ray, who says, I heard that the very powerful light on a hotel in Las Vegas that looks like a black pyramid was turned off because of its environmental impact. Do you know anything about that?
No, it hasn't. That's the Luxor. You've got 39 7,000-watt xenon lamps. In fact, I'm quoted. The picture is in the National Geographic, and I say we're not about to try to turn off the lights in Las Vegas. Every community, every civilization needs a place to go and see things. Mm-hmm. Paris, Hong Kong, Las Vegas. Ooh, ah, isn't that lovely? And keep it there. So, you know, the lighting practices that are in Las Vegas should stay in Las Vegas.
We have an email from Robbie in Carrollton who points out there are several companies that do a good job of landscape lighting. Lighting designers do take into account light pollution, at least with regard to the way neighbors are affected. I guess you just have to sort of shop around if you're looking for someone and ask the right questions as
sure.
to what their priorities are.
Yeah, it's an awareness issue. People are finally becoming aware that there is something to it. And the market has responded by coming up with products and design that are actually, you know, worthwhile, and we consider them dark sky friendly. If you go to our website, we have now 73 manufacturers that are participating in our fixture seal of approval program, where we look at the photometry from their luminaires, and if you need to pick out a bollard or a wall pack or some issue that a contractor is trying to find a good dark sky friendly product, our website has it. So they are coming about. What we need is more residential luminaires that are that sort of design. And I think as more ordinances come out, the industry will respond and we'll see more and more products.
Can you talk a little bit about how the International Dark Sky Association is set up? And I know that there are sections really all over the world of people who decide that this is an issue they want to work on.
Yeah, we have, it's purely membership driven. We have 12,000 members have signed up. There's about 6,000 that are active. And that's how we're funded. Try to travel the world and promote good lighting practices. We're working with every entity we can. I'm worked with the Department of Energy for their Energy Star criteria for the new LED streetlights. Working with the EPA, and they have the Energy Star criteria for residential lighting. I'm a member of the Illuminating Engineering Society of North America. There are task force and committees that do lighting level recommendations. So we try to be as active and involved as we can in every way we can, whether it be with the sea turtle people, conservation groups, the lighting industry itself, utilities, regulatory agencies, as many places as we can possibly fit ourselves.
How much interest do you find on a federal level for even considering mandates that would govern how municipalities light their streets?
They pretty much want to keep it a let the entity themselves decide.
Right.
And, you know, some states have come up with some, but the ones that are going to be more stringent are, either county or city localized areas. I haven't seen anything done on, even suggested on a federal level. But establishing criteria that, for Energy Star streetlights, if they're going to be LED type, which is the up-and-coming thing, they specified that they need to be full cutoff. In other words, an Energy Star rated product can't be wasteful in its lighting design, which makes sense. But it took me and other folks out there to lobby them to say this is what really needs to be considered. And that sort of, impact in the future will have a substantial bearing on it, because a community will specify, okay, it has to be Energy Star rated. And that in and of itself has a lot of impact now, because the design is going to be such that it will be a dark sky friendly product.
What are you seeing in the developing world? It's easy for us to forget that there are parts of the world that are just now sort of coming online with access to electricity in every house. Are is this sort of on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, just too high up the ladder for people to consider?
No, there's several organizations of lighting up in developing communities. It primarily has to do with what we call leapfrogging, avoiding the bad technology. There's really no reason that, you know, a developing nation would have to go through the mistake of mercury vapor light that's inefficient, and then go to high-pressure sodium or low-pressure sodium and eventually evolve into the most energy efficient. There's no reason to go through that process. It best is to go, boom, right into something that doesn't need a lot of energy in the first place. So, you know, small-scale LED type of installations, solar-powered, where you don't need a lot of infrastructure to come in. It needs to be financed by, you know, foundations or organizations that will do this, but what you're asking about is definitely something that's being acted upon right now.
Is there a particular country that you could name anywhere on the globe that has done, as far as you're concerned, an exceptional job at protecting the skies?
Country? No. I'd say one that's probably made the best effort thus far. Czechoslovakia has now a lighting ordinance that is country-based. Australia does. Slovenia have based entirely on the country. We'll find out together how well they're enforced. These are something, you know, this sort of regulation is brand new. But it's coming out not because people want to see the Milky Way. It's coming out because energy is expensive. And there are reaching limitations to what we can do with generating capacity. So efficiency is seen as the resource. And if you can come up with more efficient products, use a reflector, don't throw light where you don't need it. That's seen as the real way that dark skies are going to return.
Do you think that it will be darker on this planet in, say, a couple of decades?
I think it will, sure, because we're going to get rid of bad practices. You know, as I call it, we don't have the luxury of waste. A lot of the bad lighting practices were developed in the 50s and 60s when the atomic genie was your friend, and, you know, the energy was be too cheap to meter, so let's light it up because we can. And those days are over. We're going to have to say, okay, we have to watch out with how much coal we're burning. How much is this kilowatt costing? Where can we better spend our dollars? How can we allocate our energy reserves better? And as a result, we're going to say, well, there's no reason to light up the bottom of airplanes. Let's change that.
Is there an ideal percentage of dark sky areas that you would like to see over the Earth's land, understanding that there will be places where you can't ever fully achieve?
We got 7/10 of the world is ocean, so that sort of percentage is already achieved. I'd say it's just a reasonable practice that there's no reason to have the high degree of lighting levels that are so commonly seen based upon nothing, based upon simply because we can.
Pete Strasser is Senior Technical Advisor for the International Dark Sky Association. You can find them online at darksky.org. Pete, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
I appreciate it.
You can also learn more in the November issue of National Geographic Magazine. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.